Okay, so a Benedictine, a Dominican, and a Jesuit are all arrested during an ICE protest. In the holding cell, the Benedictine prays, the Dominican preaches, and the Jesuit starts a reading group on police abolition. So yeah, I'm Matthew Remsky, and the only thing worse than an anti-fascist dad joke is an anti-fascist nerdy post-Catholic dad joke about Jesuits. But here we are. Welcome to Episode 7, Anti-Fascist Father, with David Inchauskas. He's a Jesuit priest helping to lead faith-based protests at ICE detention facilities in Chicago.
In liberation theology and also in the broader Catholic social teaching, we speak about social sin. And I think that it's important to talk about social sin, because actually this problem of the United States treating migrants with inhumanity extends beyond, sadly, but very really, extends beyond the Trump administration. The Trump administration is doing these attacks against the migrant community in a particularly horrific and inhumane way and on a massive scale. And they're also publicizing and sensationalizing it in a particular way. But of course, we know that Biden and Obama and Bush and generations of US officials have been persecuting migrants. And also, again, and I'll repeat it, I think it's important to repeat, would be many migrants who have roots in indigenous communities in the United States. So it's a colonial power that's imposing this authority on many people who come from a mestizaje background. So there's so many layers of cruelty that are happening here, and it's happening in the context of a social sin, a structural sin that actually goes way back in history to the times of colonization. And there's a thread that runs from that to the present moment. So we're saying, like, God, have mercy on us for all of that and inspire us to change. Because, like, when you make a good act of contrition as a Catholic, you acknowledge the wrongdoing, but you also promise to, like, not do it again, like, to resist the temptation in the future.
But first,
it's like, I don't know how you can go out and protest the structure of the entire economic system if you can't keep your room organized.
So yes, housekeeping. You can find me on Blue Sky and at Instagram under my name, and on YouTube as Anti-Fascist Dad. I'm also on TikTok under that handle, where I try to post several mini essays a week. If you happen to be on my YouTube channel, you can check out my version there of my review of Scott Galloway's Notes on Being a Man. I've put subtitles in, there's chapter headings. I'm trying to make things really orderly, well-paced, and accessible over on YouTube. My Patreon is Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast, where all part twos are, plus extras, and they're exclusive there for a while, but then everything gets released to the wild. So today you can hear the first half of my interview with Father David here, and then you'll be able to catch the second half on Patreon. It's up right now. Now last, once again in the show notes, you will see a pre-order link for the book that this podcast is based on and supporting. It's called Anti-Fascist Dad, Urgent Conversations with Young People in Chaotic Times. The publication date is April 26th, 2026. So I'm going to skip the fascist squish, anti-fascist news this week, because my intro to this interview is a little bit long. I want to take about 10 minutes to get personally, but also ideologically clear on my position toward religion in the context of anti-fascism and anti-capitalism for this project. After all, my first episode in this stream featured a long conversation with Nathan Evans Fox about the impact that charismatic Christianity had on his life and politics. I hadn't really planned that, but that's what happened. And it makes sense, because I found out about him because of Hillbilly Hymn, his viral song. And then in episode 2, I asked Sarah Rasik about the role of Muslim and Jewish ritual at the anti-genocide encampments of the spring of 2024. But today, I'm interviewing a fully ordained Catholic priest in his collar and the whole nine yards. So here's the personal side, greatly abbreviated. I grew up as what I might call a diversity Catholic, meaning in my early church experience, I went to a left-wing social gospel church, and then later on, I went to a conservative church. Now, I loved the former, but it was always the minority Catholic experience in this city. I'm in Toronto, and I think also in the world, especially in the global north. And as I got into my teens in the 1980s, the rightward tilt of the Vatican, and of course everything else globally, meant that that left-wing militant flank of Catholic religiosity was increasingly repressed and just less visible to me. And by my early 20s, I'd left Catholicism behind. There was just too much anti-communism, too many hypocrisies, too many exclusionary attitudes towards women and queer people, and also an utterly shameful role in colonization. And my family had been impacted by clerical abuse. But despite all that, I've never not been haunted by this primal image of a wild, unhoused, migrant, working-class prophet who comforted his comrades in a time of colonial occupation, who jolted his birth religion out of apathy, and who made love and self-sacrifice the highest service. Now, about 5 years ago, I started tuning into the figure of Pope Francis. This guy was a Jesuit from the global south. He was familiar with and sympathetic to liberation theology. Francis had a science background, and he wrote this astonishingly beautiful letter, Laudate Si, about our ecological responsibilities. He invited indigenous leaders from the Amazon to Rome. He had lunch with trans sex workers, and he came to Canada to give a formal apology to the descendants of the First Nations people the church had helped to colonize. His mantra was todos, 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 or everyone, everyone, everyone is welcome. And now his successor, Leo, is pushing this same left-wing stream of the church forward. So where does this all leave me personally? Well, I'm writing this intro on the morning of my 54th birthday, and I just got back from morning mass at the local church. Now, I haven't been in a long time, and it brought up a lot of rich and somewhat conflicting feelings, and I could bore you with describing all of that, but I think it's just as private and maybe as weird as I'm sure your own struggles are. And I think it would get off track from why I really went and might continue to go. So here's the ideological part. I don't think the religious world is structurally different from the political world. It's groups of people gathering to administrate resources and express values. Now, a lot of religious life serves to spiritualize the status quo of capitalism and heteropatriarchy. It is opportunistic and parasitical. I mean, just think about all those clerics who were ride or die with the colonizers. Current fascist movements make great use of these aspects. And I've spent years documenting the toxic side of religious life for Conspirituality Podcast. But in every major religion I'm aware of, there is a radical, mystical, often communistic flank that rises and falls according to social need and according to also how vigorously it's repressed. So for me at this point, religion itself is a landscape of struggle. And at this point, the religion I was born into, and I know like a mother tongue, is increasingly rising up to offer resistance to capitalism. And I find that very interesting and unexpected. I have a connection to 1.8 billion people through this heritage. And if I can participate in and help nurture the radical flank within it, I should probably try to do that. Now, the Democratic Socialists of America have a committee that caught my eye a number of years ago. This is from their website. Quote, DSA's Religion and Socialism group is open to DSA members of all faiths whose socialism is in some way inspired by their spiritual identity. There is a long tradition of religious socialism in the United States that has been ignored or forgotten. The Religion and Socialism group of DSA refuses to cede the ground of faith to the religious right. Many in faith-based communities hesitate to join a socialist movement because of what they perceive as an anti-religious bias among leftists. We see ourselves as a bridge group. Our work is with and within faith communities as allies and coalition partners. Examples of such work include the New Sanctuary Movement, religion and labor coalitions, reproductive justice, and LGBTQ advocacy. Now, I'm just going to reiterate that it's no joke that the current Pope is out there speaking Donald Trump's native tongue and telling almost 2 billion people that Catholicism is basically anti-capitalist and that it must welcome the poor and the unhoused and the undocumented. Also, I think it would be a mistake, as the DSA suggests, to cede the ground of faith to the religious right. I sat and knelt in Catholic pews for far too many years to let J.D. Vance tell the world what being Catholic means. Now, two final points I want to make. In part two of my interview with David Inchauskas, I ask him whether his sense of faith is what I'm hearing when I hear his upbeat and industrious tone. And I asked him because the leftist world is often filled with the melancholy of persistent loss. And those who are depressed will often defend themselves with irony. It can be a world haunted by betrayal and distrust because it's filled with people who are up against impossible odds. But what do people do when they're up against impossible odds? I think it's natural to imagine and fantasize seemingly impossible answers. Anarchists dream of the state withering away around new networks of mutual aid. Marxists dream of the end of capitalism. Liberation theologians dream of a church on earth where everyone is cared for and supported. Now, atheist revolutionaries will say things like, the future is unwritten. And Catholic radicals will say, in God all things are possible. And you might quibble with the supposed magical thinking of the latter, but I think there can be an overlap there because each points to a space of imagination and certain degrees of hope that ideally let a person greet each new day, as horrible as the times might be, with a sense of security and reassurance, some feeling that it is all worth it, or it will be, even if one cannot see it in full. Isn't this the root gift of the Black spiritual, composed and sung by enslaved people? So, just wrapping up this Anti-Fascist Dad podcast and religion mission statement, I'm reading a very somber book by the anarchist Peter Gelderloos called They Will Beat the Memory Out of Us, Forcing Nonviolence on Forgetful Movements. And what strikes me most about his account of trying to find sustainability in resistance cultures is how often young people find themselves having to create culture from scratch after previous generations of activists and revolutionaries have been repressed, injured, traumatized, or jailed. All of those hardships are measures of commitment, and so what I say here is no shade on that. But the thing about being 54 and going back to Mass is that when I open my mouth to utter those prayers, I am not alone. I am reconnected with countless people around the world of all backgrounds, but also to millennia of yearning and contemplation. We know how all of that social capital can be pulled in bad directions, but we also know how to pull back. And it also has a stubborn weight to it. It doesn't move quickly. And I think it's worth thinking closely about the places in which we find strength because they have been cared for generations. So on to my guest for this week, David Inchauskas. He was born in Hinsdale, Illinois, and adopted through Catholic Charities. He was a high school valedictorian and graduate of Wake Forest, but he then met the Jesuits while studying liberation theology at Oxford University in England in 2012. He's got a ton of degrees. He's now a doctoral student in philosophy at Loyola University Chicago, where he focuses on Latin American liberation philosophy. Also at Loyola Chicago, he serves as chaplain to the men's volleyball team and to the Spanglish Christian Life community. Now, I got to know about him because of his excellent Liberation Theology podcast, which I'll link to. But then I also saw on Instagram that he's taking a leadership role in protesting the illegal detention of immigrants and migrant workers in the Chicago Broadview ICE Detention Center. They are carrying out the nonviolent direct action of bringing communion to ICE detainees, many of whom are Latin American Catholics. Now, bringing ritual bread and wine to prisoners goes way back to the origins of Christianity, to the story of the very young Saint Tarsicius, who was murdered by a mob of Roman youth for attempting to deliver communion to imprisoned Christians. So I grew up with these stories of bringing the body and blood to prison or to the hospital or to the nursing home. And here's my understanding of this action. I think they're taking the church out of the building and to the place of struggle. The church is not the structure or the altar. It is acts of love and service. They are connecting the body of Jesus to the bodies of the incarcerated and to their own bodies. They are using a symbol of metaphysical transformation to make a direct materialist intervention. And they're not just carrying the communion, they are embodying it and the life it represents, and also the death as well, because there's a non-zero chance that they'll be shot. So David and his friends, women and men in religious orders, surrounded by lay people, are taking a stand. And in this, they join a long lineage of American religious who have stood up to fascism for over a century. Now, what motivates him? In our interview, he'll be talking through some of the implications of liberation theology. But here's the 101. Liberation theology is a radical recentering of Christianity around the material lives of the poor. And it emerges from Latin America in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Its foundational text is Gustavo Gutierrez's A Theology of Liberation, 1971, which insists that spiritual salvation and social liberation are inseparable, and that poverty is not fate or divine mystery, but a product of exploitative systems for which societies are responsible. The poor are described not as objects of charity, but as subjects of history. Oppressed, exploited proletariat, whose suffering demands a transformed social order, not band-aid reform. One core liberation theology concept is the, quote, preferential option for the poor, unquote, which becomes both a moral mandate and a structural aim. It basically says your faith, your society, and your church are defined by how you organize life around those with the least. The theological method of liberation theology is summarized as see, judge, and act, beginning with the concrete realities of the oppressed that are then interpreted with theological tools, and then the person organizes along with others for change. So liberation theology flows from observation and struggle. It doesn't descend from some kind of abstract doctrine. Now, I have a big episode on liberation theology up on Conspirituality that I'll link to. It's about the fact that liberation theology was such a compelling movement in the global South in the 1970s that the CIA sought to undermine it, partly by funding the expansion of evangelical missionaries in Latin America, because they were teaching obedience and the prosperity gospel. The Vatican, in low-key Red Scare mode, helped the CIA in this effort by criticizing the liberation theologians for their reliance on Marxist analysis and their hesitance to categorically condemn revolutionary violence. But all of that is turning slowly. Father Robert Prevost, who's now Pope Leo XIV, is out there in the world criticizing Trump and other fascists without having to name them, because everybody knows who he's talking about. And he's doing so by leaning into liberation theology with his full chest, even dedicating his first major publication to the subject of loving and serving the poor. So out in front of that, on the ground, is my guest. Father David Inchauskas, welcome to Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Matthew.
Thank you for being here. So this podcast is usually about caregiving in a time of fascism from a familial angle. I'm wondering if we can dub you Anti-Fascist Father for this interview and just start with understanding your vocation a little bit and how it is similar and dissimilar from the family life of a lot of us that a lot of us know. So is Anti-Fascist Father okay for today?
I certainly am an anti-fascist. I am against fascism, and I also am a Catholic priest, so I think that those two together make sense to me.
Okay, so just some basic details for those who might be unfamiliar with the vocation. You know, straight up, do you own anything?
Complicated question. I would say yes and no. So I do have a private bank account that's in my name. At the same time, any money that I would earn, for example, when I was a professor at Xavier University, that money would go into a community account, and then I would fill out a budget request that I would send to my superior, who would also be attached to the account, and then that money would be deposited into my account. You know, I do, right now we're recording. I'm recording from my room in the Jesuit community at Ignatius House, so I do have my own bedroom, as well as my own bathroom, which is great. But we do share a common kitchen, common living areas. And it is extraordinary in a sense that I do live in a house with 25 other people. So I do have that private bank account. At the same time, any money that would go in there is filtered through the superior. And that's part of our vow of poverty, in fact, would be to have it done in that way. And any money that I receive, you know, I don't directly receive, but it goes to the community as a whole.
Well, speaking of living circumstances, my next question was, you know, given the fact that you do not have a family life, as a lot of people do, do you get lonely?
Oh, I think I do get lonely. Maybe I wouldn't say that I get especially lonely, in the sense that I think, you know, as you point out, Matthew, we're living in a time of great isolation, and isolation is one of the preconditions, I think, that gives rise to fascism. And people crave community life. I think we're social, political beings, and part of our way of establishing meaning in this world is through community. So I consider, in fact, the fact that I do get to live in a community with 25 other guys. We have mass every day. We have a social. We have dinner together every day. For about 45 minutes to an hour every day, I'm sitting at a table with four or five of my Jesuit brothers. That is kind of extraordinary.
Yeah.
in an era that is so defined by individualism, and also that's defined by loneliness. So, you know, I think as a human being, I do get lonely, and that's part of our experience, but I'm so grateful that I live in a community life. And I think maybe that's part of the Jesuit vocation and the priestly vocation that maybe some people don't consider, would be at least in the Jesuits, our way of living out the priesthood is not living in the little home next to the church where you live by yourself.
Right.
But in the case of the Jesuits, you know, we really place a strong emphasis on community life. And I feel blessed in that way.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, maybe it means that Jesuit community life is like prefigurative of a kind of anti-fascist social organization, if you're saying that, you know, it reduces isolation. You know, it's going to provide some kind of bulwark against that.
I think that's right. And the other part of it would be that it's an intergenerational community.
Wow.
And so, you know, last year, I was the youngest guy in the community. This year, there's two guys who have arrived who are even younger than I am, which is great, but it spans all the way, you know, up to priests who are in their 80s and 90s. So this is also a huge blessing, I think, in a time where there's these intergenerational gaps. I feel that it's also a huge blessing to be able to live with the wisdom of people, you know, who have much more life experience than I do. But then also, I think, you know, the youth offers a fresh perspective as well. And so we learn a lot from each other. And we have that kind of solidarity across generations, which I think is pretty rare today.
Well, it certainly aids in cultural memory. Like, how do we address these particular problems? And how are we going to go forward? And that's amazing. But with regard to life experiences, I just want to confess that my dad used to grumble a little bit about priests who were like out of touch with family life. And, you know, if they would give sermons about things that should happen domestically or things like that, he would say things like, well, they need to change a diaper or two before giving any advice or counsel. And I'm wondering if you have to do some kind of, I don't know, domestic research or community research to keep you grounded in the larger needs of the Catholic family.
Yeah, great question. Well, I would have to admit, I think that for me to give advice to parents about parenting does not really compute for me, as
right.
I do have no life experience in that area. At the same time, I do have a family. You know, actually, I was adopted, and I was adopted at birth, and I have my siblings and that family experience. Now, my two siblings are also younger than me, and neither of them have children, though I'd, you know, be happy to the degree that it makes sense in our situation, you know, for me to accompany them as well as an uncle to any nieces or nephews who may be on the way, of course. But then I think part of it is also the importance of simply having friends.
Right.
Because it's true. And to the degree that I isolate myself in this community, then I'm not going to have that experience. But the degree to which a Jesuit might proceed in a more pastoral fashion to have friends who are outside of the Society of Jesus, lay women and men who do open the doors to their family life. This was one of my great experiences when I was in France, is I worked for this group that was doing social entrepreneurship. So it's projects that are innovative, but are also dedicated to the common good. So not thinking about, you know, enterprising for the sake of private gain, as is often the case, but for the sake of addressing some kind of community need. And the director of this organization, Pauline, had me over for family vacations, also for meals and in her house. I got to know her children, and I feel like that is so important. Maybe I feel like I don't think of it as research or deliberate in that sense, but I think it's something that organically happens
right.
If a priest seeks a life which is close to the people of God.
Now, here's a harder question. And this is not a Catholic podcast, and there's going to be a lot of non-Catholic, leftist, anti-fascist listeners who might have negative views of the church, given the status of women within it, teachings on reproductive rights, policies around queerness, the handling of clerical abuse. So to the extent that your vocation relates you to these views and this institution, what would you say to the non-Catholic listener who is wondering what they have in common with you, you know, in the fight against ICE, for example, or, you know, if any of these issues are a barrier for listening to what you have to say?
Well, I would say the church offers a critique of capitalism. that I find very powerful. Of course, I think all of this is related to the person of Jesus Christ. Like the church, to the degree that it's doing what it should be doing, is going back to the person of Jesus Christ. And what do we see in the person of Jesus Christ? But an anti-imperial critique, a critique of the domination of politics, a certain idea about servant leadership as opposed to dominant leadership, also obediential leadership, that leaders in the political community, to the degree that they're doing what they should be doing, should be listening and obeying the masses of the people in the political body. Also a critique of economics. Of course, Jesus is very famous for his critique of wealth, you know, saying that it's more likely for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to inherit the reign of God. And then in Jesus' first major speech, what does he say? He says, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the reign of God." Now, I think oftentimes that the idea of the kingdom or reign of God has been so disaffiliated from life on earth, when actually this is precisely what Jesus Christ was all about in the Our Father. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So when Jesus is saying that radical line, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the reign of God," Jesus is offering an alternative society that not only applies to the heavenly realm. I certainly do believe in the afterlife, and I believe that there'll be radical changes in social life that will occur in the afterlife. But Jesus is not merely speaking about that, but also about the present. And then he followed that up with, in Luke's gospel, these series of woes. Woe to you who are rich. Woe to you who are not hungry. You've had your fill. And so we see this radical egalitarianism that is part of Jesus' message. And also, Jesus was critical of religious authorities of his day as well. And I think the church also, when it's at its best, preserves some of that skepticism to some degree about religious authority, because Jesus showed the way. He said that the way to lead is not as the Gentiles lead. And when he says that, he means the Roman Empire.
Right.
That's not the way that we do leadership, but leadership is through service. So I think that lay people also in the church, you know, should encourage their pastors to be servant leaders and to be listening people. And this is something that Pope Francis and Pope Leo have been encouraging a lot. They have this idea that they call synodality. Synodality is the idea that the church walks together. It's not like the priest is in a radically hierarchical relationship with the rest of the people of God, but rather the priest has an obediential authority of service. So I think in all of those ways, also, I'd have to say, I think the church has offered, especially in recent times, a radical critique of the climate catastrophe.
Right.
We saw this in Pope Francis with the document Laudato Si, where he criticizes this relationship between capitalism, which is premised on the idea of endless growth. But we know that that does not equate very well with our Earth and its limited resources, and also the affiliation that we see between increases in productivity and growth in capitalism and also carbon emissions and the destruction of the environment. So I think this goes back to the simple idea, which is that all of creation is good. The human body is good. Everything about the material world is good. And so when we do harm to the material world and to the ecosystem, in a way, we're disrespecting the creation of God. And so I think the Catholic Church offers a critique there. So I think that the Catholic Church, in many ways, can be a partner with people who are anti-fascist, because we share many of the common goals with each other, which have to do with equality, which have to do with a different way of relating to our environment. And I believe that there is, wherever there is conflict in society, conflict is also reproduced in the church. And so there's a few different ways that I think people on the left can approach the church. One way would be to totally dismiss the church, which in a way cedes the church to the right, and the church becomes a Christo-fascist space. Or you could say, well, I'm going to like not relate, or maybe even go against, you know, what the church is saying. But what I've been promoting and what I think liberation theology promotes is kind of an idea of looking at what are the places where the church and people on the left can collaborate together on common projects. And certainly one of them these days has been the struggle of migrants. And I've been a little bit part of that movement in the defense of migrants here in Chicago who are being wrongfully detained also on colonized land. So I think we need to also see how the Catholic Church can be a partner to people on the left. And I think in many ways today we're seeing that.
That is a lot, Father David, and it gets us right into liberation theology. But to really make this sort of practical for listeners, I think if, let's say that you and I show up and we are active at the same ICE protest, and I am, you know, sort of Catholic sympathetic, but I have strong disagreements with some of the sort of social teachings around the church, but I know that you represent them, but you might not have them front of mind. That might not be why you're there. After all, it's not like an anti-abortion protest. It's actually a protest against ICE. I think that the real sort of practical question is like, does that come between us? And if that comes between us, do I no longer cooperate with you? And do, you know, does the more rightward leaning Catholic begin to take over that space? I think that seems to be the crucial practical question.
Well, I think that there is certainly a tendency that we see all around, which is this question of ideological purity, which is that unless you and I agree on every issue, then we're not going to be able to collaborate with each other. But I don't think that this is really a strong way of proceeding in terms of building power and building solidarity and building a movement, right? Because in fact, people are radically diverse in their backgrounds, in their beliefs on politics and religion. And so I think that as opposed to finding ways for us to exclude each other, we should find ways to include each other in common struggles. And so I think that's probably a better way of approaching coalition building, is there are differences, but where can we find common ground in order to strategize together? And I also think on the main issues of our day, which for me would be the struggle against capitalism and the struggle against climate change, the Catholic Church and people who are on the left have a large amount of common ground. And so I think that we should build up power together. This is actually one of the things that is, I think, unique and important to highlight about the Latin American church, because the Latin American church in so many ways has shown that liberative movements and the Catholic Church can go together, whether it's Miguel Hidalgo in the independence of Mexico from colonial powers in Europe, whether it's the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, who said that they were going to propose a humanist socialism that's also Christian. And so we've seen kind of throughout the history of Latin America that in radical ways, the church and revolutionary movements can come together to promote the common good. And I think that the U.S. church can learn from that from both sides. You know, what does the Catholic Church have to learn and grow into to be a better partner to liberation movements, and how also can liberation movements not be exclusionary of Catholics and Christians and people of other religions as well, who are more than happy to join forces.
Getting right down to how all of your background and your facility with and love for liberation theology brings you to the present moment, why has it been important for you to participate in these efforts to bring the Eucharist to detainees in that Chicago ICE facility?
Yes. So as the Coalition for Spiritual and Public Leadership, we've articulated three goals that we're seeking as we're attempting to bring communion to detainees in Broadview. The first one would be simply, we do believe in the fundamental human right for people to freely exercise their religion. And communion is, for Catholics, the source and summit of our faith. It's so integral to who we are. And it brings comfort, it brings strength and solidarity, and it unites us as one body. And so I would say, for those who are detained, that simple act of communion, as actually folks have been reminding me and our movement of, it's really showing the solidarity and the humanity of the people who are detained in that facility. It's highlighting that humanity and connectedness, which brings unity in the church. So that's one, for the sake of the detainees and their fundamental right to the free exercise of religion. But then the other parts of it would be that we know that we're living in an era in which the meaning of Christianity is very contested. And it always has been contested, but I think we're seeing it in a particular way in this moment.
Right.
And what we want to show is that the Catholic Church is not going to be silent in the face of the oppression of our migrant sisters and brothers. And so it's also a public witness, where the church is giving witness for really the whole country and also for the Trump administration to see that we're not going to allow this to happen without resisting. And one of the first steps in resistance is to do it in a peaceful and humble manner. And what we have seen is that that has not worked, in fact, in these cases, which demonstrates that potentially we should consider the next step, which is civil disobedience. But what it does demonstrate is that we have tried. And I think the public has seen this, the great act of humility that occurred in this moment when my brother priests and sisters and lay people very humbly communicated with the Illinois State Police, who relayed the message to ICE, and ICE says no. And then humbly they turn around and enter into a moment of song and prayer. And seeing that humility also speaks volumes to the general public, that that is something that has been tried and has not been listened to.
So there is something strategic about the performance of this first attempt and what it displays. So the basis for us wanting to come to these detainees is the basis of religious freedom and nurturance. And we are being turned away. Obviously, we are not a danger to the state. Right? Obviously, we're not a danger to the facility. The strategy is in showing the public that a very reasonable and actually generous appeal is being turned away.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I wish that they would have let us in. And in fact,
right. That's not your intention.
Yeah, that's the primary intention, is that I wish that they would have let us in. And in fact, some people, especially those who are more on the Catholic right, have said that we're using the Eucharist as a political football. I don't think that this is the case. Actually, the Catholic Church, all throughout the world, every day, offers communion to detainees and to those who are in prison.
Yes, right.
And what was rendered political in this moment was actually the rejection. You know, if ICE would have simply let us into the facility to do what the Catholic Church does every day, then this would have not been a particularly political moment. But they made the decision to deny that right. And what it does is it also reveals, then the public asks the question, and certainly, why? Why are they being denied this right? And we know that the answer is, and it amplifies this, that those who are inside that facility are being treated in such horrible, inhumane conditions that even the simple act of allowing like a nun and a priest into that facility to see what is going on inside runs the risk of them giving a first-person account to the public about what they've seen inside. Because right now, the reports that we have about the conditions inside that facility are coming from either people who were detained wrongfully, and then all of them are detained wrongfully, but under the eyes of the administration, you know, they're detained wrongfully and they're actually U.S. citizens, for example, and then they're released. Or they're people who are deported, and then from maybe Mexico or from Honduras, then they're giving a report about the conditions that are inside. So Senator Dick Durbin, Senator Tammy Duckworth, they're not allowed inside this facility. The only public personality who's been allowed in this facility is Kristi Noem,
right,
whose opinion, of course, we don't trust at all. And we've seen her images of her posing in front of detainees treated in horrible conditions in El Salvador. So why would we expect anything different to be happening in the suburbs of Chicago? Then the last, I think, reason that we're doing what we're doing is because we want to bring strength and solidarity to ourselves. I think we call upon grace. This is a moment of prayer, and we need strength in order to persevere in this struggle. And I don't know about you, but I can't do this alone. I mean, this is a spiritual struggle, and it's a struggle in our hearts as well. Like, can I muster enough courage in order to resist? And that's where I call upon God, but also we are strengthened by gathering together. Like when you see 2,000 fellow Catholics outside of this facility singing and praying together, you say, I'm not alone in this struggle. And it gives me the courage to maybe even take the next more radical steps that we need to do to resist.
So that's the show, folks, except for Fascist Dad of the Week.
I have your statement about the new Epstein emails that have been released by House Democrats. Separate from why you believe the emails were made public, can you address their substance? Did the president ever spend hours at Jeffrey Epstein's house with a victim?
These emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong.
Okay, gender bending this time, because Fash Dad energy is not about the genitals, folks. There are lots of ways to be a Fash Dad, and sometimes that means serving Fash Dad Superior. So yes, this is White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt lying her soul into oblivion about Trump's relationship to Jeffrey Epstein, and doing so through layers of faux dignity. I just had to put her up front this week for a little reality check on my liberation theology nerding out, because, I mean, she's a Catholic too. And at 28, she has given her whole life over to lying so that a decrepit sex criminal can continue to accumulate power. In some ways, Caroline is the most tragic type of Fash Dad, the woman toady in a woman-hating administration who will fawn and debase themselves lower and lower every day until they are all used up and the leader throws them away. But I guess for Caroline, there's always confession. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you on Patreon or back here on the main feed.